Is Peter weak or strong? I mean, on one hand, he has the courage to draw a sword, right? First of all, am I the only one that just really enjoys that the disciples are walking around carrying swords? That is an excellent, excellent little fact that I think needs to be part of a VBS somewhere. Peter has the courage to step up for Jesus. Wouldn't we all want to be the ones who were able to step up and say, not on my watch, you're not taking Jesus now. He follows him into the courtyard of the high priest, maybe one other disciple. There's nothing that tells us the other disciples had scattered quite yet, but certainly there was confusion and probably maybe Peter and one other disciple are there in the courtyard of the high priest. Like, this took some natural courage. Peter had some strength of character to him. On the other hand, Jesus tells him to put his sword away. The very thing that we would point to and say, this is the show of courage, Jesus condemns or at least tells him to stop it. And of course, Peter's great failure. He denies even knowing Jesus. You know, I don't know that it's right to say that he denied Jesus, although that shorthand, he denied having a relationship with Jesus. He denied knowing Jesus. He's not here to say, yeah, kill him, but he is here to say, I've got nothing to do with him. So is Peter weak or strong? Well, let's start by saying this is a narrative. It's a story. So before we decide what we're supposed to learn from this story, let's focus our eyes on just exactly what happened. Let's start with the context of Peter's story. You know, you can't get rid of the location. First, let's consider the location. Our story begins in a familiar place, this olive grove, this probably a private garden where Jesus and his disciples had access to it. They had been here before. Jesus had been in this place before. Jesus had been in this place before with Peter. Jesus had been in this place before with Judas. Probably a place of natural beauty, and olive grove is a pretty little place to be. And also, it probably was private property. It was probably somewhere that Jesus and his disciples kind of knew the place and had a key, or somebody was letting them in. They were allowed to be there. The Jewish culture, the tradition was that you had to be in Jerusalem at the night of Passover. So apparently this place is kind of like gets the borders of Jerusalem for the feast get expanded a little bit. It would be like getting a hotel room in Seaside and saying I was, you know, in Pebble Beach for the for the golf tournament or whatever. So they are Jewish men in a familiar place, celebrating the Passover in a proper way. This should have been the safest place. This should have been the place of peace. This should have been the place of peace and even friendship. Oh, the conversations maybe they could remember having in this garden. I think this, before, what we're trying to do is crawl into the skin of Peter. We're trying to go, how did Peter come to such failure from such strength? I think just the setting highlights the intimacy of the betrayal. This was a betrayal of the whole group. We think about Judas betraying Jesus, but didn't Judas betray Peter too? Didn't Judas betray the whole mission from the other disciples' limited perspective? Wasn't Peter looking at Judas going, if I had a minute with that guy, my sword wouldn't be for Malchus, it'd be for Judas. What would you have done if you were there in that garden? Run? Punch Judas? I'd like to think I wouldn't have drawn a sword, but I would have gone, all right, dude, right now, me and you. Would you have broken down and cried? Can you feel the intensity of emotion here? As you're standing in this garden in the dimly lit dark of night with torches, and you see what's happening in front of you? Let's consider the arresting party. What is it that Peter is actually looking at? Other translations say detachment. I think Susan just read the word detachment to us. Some say company. The ESV says it's a band of soldiers. Other translations say it's a cohort. So if that is kind of the word that it looks like it is, it means that there might have been 600 to 1,000 soldiers in this garden. Man, me, I go to arrest one like carpenter from Galilee, we're going to send 600 dudes. But yeah, then there's some history behind that too. And as you think about why would it look like that, let me tell you, Rome is not messing around. Rome does not go and bring you downtown for questioning. Rome goes and gets you. They're going to stop revolt right at the bud. And so they showed up with force. Also, there were large numbers of soldiers in town to keep the peace at the Passover. And so they had bodies to throw at this. So as Peter is looking, you know, on the flannel graph when you're in third grade, it's like a couple of soldiers just standing there. Probably what Peter's looking at is as far as his eyes can see, Roman soldiers who know a little bit about wreck and shop. Their head, the fight or flight is absolutely like coursing through this guy's veins. So 600 soldiers. Not only that, but there's members of the Sanhedrin, or at least their servants. And by servant, don't think the Sanhedrin sent their foot washers. No, these are their hired officials. They send the chief of staff. They send their head of security. Hey, go with the Romans and make sure we get our man. The religious, like, city council is among the arresting party. Not only that, but members of the priesthood. Like, the priests have come and stood next to the Roman soldiers. Do you know how insane that sounds? That there is an arresting party filled with Jewish priests and Roman soldiers both saying, yeah, he's the bad guy? Talk about strange bedfellows. What are these guys doing together? That's one of your questions for your in-group. Figure it out. What had to be happening that the Jewish priests and the Roman cohort have bound together to arrest this one rabbi? And then right in the middle of all of this crowd, there's our old buddy Judas, just standing there, been stealing from the money bag, and we all know it. Left the party early because Jesus had, you know, there had been a morsel dipped in a cup. And now there he is. Now, I don't know if you're a ready, fire, aim guy or if you're a more thoughtful person, but this would be an intense situation. Throw a punch or run is what most of us would do. This was intense. Fear would be appropriate. The disciples are, you know, also it says that these guys are carrying torches. Like, you know, the opening scene in Shrek, right? Where they're all coming to get Shrek. It's like that. They've got torches and lanterns. These lanterns are these clay pots with fire inside them. And they've got those, and they're like Ichabod Crane, like looking for stuff. I don't know. And then they've got wooden torches that are on fire, and they've got swords and other weapons. What are those other weapons? He's got a cat of nine tails. He's got a mace. He's got a spear, like just loaded. Like if they were coming to fight a battle, it would not look much different. Can you picture what's going on in Peter's heart? Can you imagine? One of the interesting things about John's gospel is we don't get a lot about the emotions. John's kind of like writing almost like a newspaper reporter, and then the cohort showed up, and then Peter drew a sword. We don't get the like behind the scenes what's going on in Peter's heart. Can you imagine what would have been going on in your heart as this scene happened? And consider Jesus' reaction to the whole thing. In verse 4, it says, Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him. You know, I'm reminded again that this is John writing much later. Jesus knows what's going to happen to him. Nobody else has it figured out. In fact, even the confusion of the night, I think, has to play in as we're kind of, I don't want to defend Peter, but I certainly think we need to put ourselves in Peter's place before we can accurately figure out what we're supposed to learn from this passage. And in the confusion of the night as the foot washing has happened, I don't think you can disconnect this passage from the foot washing either. I think they are intimately connected. The foot washing has happened, and Peter has said, don't wash my feet. I changed my mind, wash my whole body. I would never betray you, even if I have to die. And then hear Jesus say, yes, you will. I mean, can you imagine? Just that would have been the most intense conversation of my entire life. And then to be confronted by a cohort of soldiers and the priests and the Sanhedrin. And so as John says, Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, it's good to remember, he is the only one that knows what's going on. The priests don't know what's going on. The Sanhedrin don't know what's going on. The Roman soldiers don't know what's going on. There is the redemption plan of all mankind is coming to its culmination in these dark hours, and Jesus is the only one who understands what's happening. Certainly, Peter doesn't. Jesus is operating out of obedience. Jesus is operating out of knowledge. You know, Peter's been given this information. He should have this knowledge, but he just hasn't put it all together, And if you don't see yourself in that, you're a better person than I am. So Peter is operating out of confusion. Peter is operating out of fear as he stands there. And I wonder if you've ever operated out of fear and confusion instead of obedience and faith. I wonder if you could put yourself in that place and go, man, it hasn't been Roman soldiers. It's been, a diagnosis, or it's been an unexpected bill, or it's been a conflict I didn't expect coming with a family member or a neighbor, but I have definitely been in a place where when I should have been operating out of knowledge and faith, instead, I'm operating out of confusion. I'm operating out of fear. Do you see yourself here? You know, of all the people in the scene, I see myself with Peter most. I don't see myself with Judas. I know I've betrayed Jesus too, but I see myself with Peter, confused, having some knowledge, but not being able to put it all together. So Jesus steps forward and asks, who are you looking for? Come on, Jesus, I think we know who they're looking for. Do you see Judas standing there? I think that you just said was going to betray you. Like, I think we know who they're looking for. And Jesus just simply says, who are you looking for? Again, Jesus is acting with purpose. Jesus is acting with love. Peter's whole life is falling apart in front of his eyes. Remember, Peter is at least married, has a mother-in-law, he's got family he's got to provide for. Like, Peter is a real guy in the world. He's been following Jesus. He gave up the fishing business so he could follow Jesus, presumably so he would be a rabbi someday too. So he would walk in the feet of the dust of his rabbi's feet, that he would learn the trade, that he would learn, and that he would go and be a teacher too. And right here in this night, his whole life is falling apart. His future is falling apart. His career is falling apart. And his best friend is being arrested. This might feel like his whole life is on the line. You know, as an interesting side note, this is one of only two places that in John where Jesus is called Jesus of Nazareth. And it was almost, most of the commentators agree, it was intended to be pejorative. Jesus from Nazareth. Who are you looking for? Not Jesus, the one who raised Lazarus. We want to talk to him. Not Jesus, the one who's healed many and speaks with authority on the temple steps. We need a word with him. But no, it's like Jesus, I hope I don't overstep. Like Jesus, the redneck. Like Jesus, that hillbilly. There's a pejorative, like just that guy that should not be bothering us. That's who we're here for. The only other time that this is used in John's gospel is in the inscription that Pilate has put on the cross above Jesus. And you remember it says, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. So this pejorative title, like Jesus from nowhere, King of the Jews. So even in there, it's like Rome is giving a little, hey, Jews, even your king is not noble. So all of this is swirling around as Peter stands there deciding what to do. Verse 5, Jesus simply responds. They say, we're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. And he simply responds with, I am he. Man, I love it every time Jesus says this. I'm me. I am. He is added in English, right? So what Jesus actually said was, I'm me. I am. Moses asks the burning bush, who do I say sent me? In the Septuagint, that's the Greek translation of the Hebrew document, I'm me. I am. For you grammar nerds out there, that is first person, singular, present, indicative. I am. Who is standing here? Who did they come to arrest? Do you see how John and so beautifully interweaves truth with truth? This one truth of Lariac. Yes, this is what happened. They came, said, who, Jesus said, who are you looking for? They said, Jesus of Nazareth. He said, that's me. But really, what's happening here? A lot, we're going to talk more about this next week, because next week we're going to look at the trials in John 18. But man, what we're supposed to be seeing here is the difference between power and power. Between the power of the Roman might and the authority of the Sanhedrin and the priesthood, and then the I am. Existence itself, God, right there in their midst. So the storm rages on the Sea of Galilee, and the disciples, Jesus isn't with them, and the disciples are terrified, and they see Jesus walking on the water, and they think it's a ghost. And then he gets him, and he says, I am. In the middle of fear and confusion, would you remember that Jesus is the I am? Jesus is singular, first person, indicative. I am. With this statement, these soldiers who have stood in the presence of, we don't know if they've actually stood in the presence of Caesar, but they certainly see Caesar as their chief, their commander in chief, who've stood in the presence of Pilate, who've stood in the presence of Roman commanders, and have gone and had all of the training and power and might. They hear Jesus say, I am, and they fall back. Because this is the first time they've seen power. Because there is a difference between earthly power and Jesus effectively working out the redemption plan of all mankind. They fall back and hit the ground. We will talk more about power next week as we look at the trials of Jesus, but maybe we should just pause for a moment and go, who are we supposed to understand is in control? In your life that might be a mess right now, who are we supposed to understand that's in control? Is it the Roman cohort? Is it 600 guys with torches and spears and swords? Or is it this Galilean rabbi leading 11 fishermen, tax collectors, and farmers? Where does real power lie? It might be one of the most foundational questions of our life. As we try to figure out, how do I live the best life? What does it really mean to live a life of love and joy and peace? We have to ask ourselves, what kind of power are we submitting to? Where does real power lie? Does the power come from political, physical might? Or does it come from obedience to God? So in this story, it is pretty clear where the power lies, and it's not with physical might. But we only know that because we've seen the end of the story. I mean, don't you look at this and see the soldiers come, and it's, you know who's like got the white hat on. You know how this story goes. You know that right now as we sit here, the tomb is empty. So you see people come to confront Jesus, and you go, oh, man, they don't know what's about to happen. But you know who really doesn't know what's about to happen is Peter. He's operating out of confusion and fear. So, verse 8 and 9, Jesus steps forward again. Who are you looking for? They answered, Jesus of Nazareth. He again says, I just told you, that's me. Then he adds, if I'm the one you're looking for, let these men go. A couple things to note about that, and I think it's important. First, John tells us to pay attention to this, to Jesus saying, if you're here for me, then let my disciples go. John tells us that's important because it fulfills Jesus' words in the high priestly prayer of the last chapter, that Jesus had kept all of his disciples safe. He had not lost any. And again, that's a good reminder. that in whatever terrible situation and whatever the future looks like, no matter how scary, it is always safest to be in step with Jesus than it is to be charting your own course in the world. And I think that that's important, and there's more meat on those bones. But what I'd like to focus on in this statement is simply this, that Peter is free to go. That Jesus, as he says, it's me, I'm the one you're looking for, you can let these guys go. Everything that Peter does from here on is just Peter's making decisions to do it. Jesus does not need Peter in any way. And maybe Peter is a little bit bought into Jesus needs me. But Jesus does not need Peter before Pilate. Jesus does not need Peter on the Via Della Rosa. Jesus does not need Peter as he hangs on the cross. This is what Jesus came to do, and he does not need Peter's help. He doesn't need a character witness. He has made a way for Peter to walk away safely. But here's the thing, Peter just can't see himself walking away. In an act of incredible physical courage, Peter instead draws his sword. Like, isn't that interesting? Right after Jesus says, let these guys go, Peter goes, no, here I go. In an act that almost certainly should have ended in his death. You think Peter, the fisherman from Galilee, thinks he has a chance against the 600 soldiers? I don't know how he didn't die. But he draws his sword because he just can't imagine Jesus doesn't need him right there. Peter needs to continue to learn that Jesus needs to wash his feet. Peter needs to continue to learn that Jesus is the Savior. And Peter's not. That it is Jesus' sacrifice that is the central piece of the redemption of mankind. That it does not start with our work. See, Peter is struggling with obedience because Peter thinks Peter is really important in the redemption story of mankind. But it does not start with our work. It does not start with what could I do for God. Rather, it starts with what God has done for Peter, for us, for me. So Peter draws a sword and he cuts the ear off a man named Malchus. And Jesus, in an act that surely saved Peter's life, said, Peter, put your sword away. And then he says, shouldn't I drink the cup that the Father has given me? You know, again, I don't know how you separate this story from the foot washing. This is so important, what Peter learned about Jesus that night. Jesus is not a man of the sword. Jesus is a man of the towel. It shocked Peter when Jesus washed his feet. And maybe it shocks him now that Jesus doesn't defend himself. But Jesus is not a man who picks up the sword to defend himself. Rather, he is a man who picks up the towel to serve. And it's not that the sword is useless in society or in a culture. People need to be defended. The poor need to be defended. The oppressed need to be defended. Don't forget that Jesus turned over some tables and grabbed a whip to defend defend people who were poor, who the religious people had put up an economic barrier so poor believing people couldn't get to church. The poor need to be defended. The oppressed need to be defended. Jesus does not need to be defended. And Peter just can't see that. So Peter draws a sword. And Jesus, recognizing the horrors that lay ahead for him, says, Peter, shouldn't I drink the cup of wrath? Shouldn't I do what my Father has asked me to do? Jesus is obedient even to death. So Jesus is obedient and sacrifices and trusts the Father. This is an example to Peter. And to us, but Peter's having a hard time figuring it out. The towel of service over the sword of violence. Service over self. Love over pride. So Jesus just says, put your sword away. And this is a conversation he and Peter have had before. Do you remember the conversation that Peter and Jesus had at Caesarea Philippi? Peter says, "I've come to know that you're the Christ, you're the Messiah." And Jesus says, "Don't tell anybody." And Peter says, "Of course. How could you say that you would have to die?" And Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan. You're not in step with me. You're in step with my enemy." You remember that Peter saw Jesus in all of his glory at the Mount of Transfiguration, and Peter wants to stay there forever. "It's right that I'm here. Let's build tabernacles, build tents for all of us, and we'll just stay here." And yet on the way down the hill, Jesus says, "Don't tell anybody what you just saw until after the resurrection." Peter is having a hard time figuring out the death that leads to life, the sacrifice that leads to glory. And maybe you and I recognize ourselves in that. You can see why Peter's having a rough night. You throw all this on top of, let's not take away the fact that not only is Jesus human, but definitely Peter is human. So on this, you throw on top of all this a sleepless and confusing time, a confusing time in the courtyard, the fear that was there, and failure was never going to be very far away. Peter's still learning about Jesus, but Peter's also learning about himself. Peter followed Jesus into the courtyard, and it looks like maybe John helped him get in. And you know, Peter's denial in the courtyard, it's pretty easy to condemn Peter, but I'll tell you, it's pretty easy to identify with him too. It's not hard to see what led Peter to deny his relationship with Jesus. There was fear. You know, not only had he barely survived this incident with the cohort in the garden, but now he's in the house of the high priest, and commentators say what this most probably looked like is a courtyard with one wing of it leading to Annas' house and one wing of it leading to Caiaphas' house. He's in the very seat of high priestly power. There had to be some fear as he's there with the one being tried. The arrest has just happened, and apparently some of the same guys are standing around from the garden. Malchus, I wonder who that was. It says it was a relative of Malchus that Peter denied Jesus to the third time. Was that his cousin? Was that his brother? Can you imagine what was going through his head? "You just cut my brother's ear off. I know that was you." "No, it wasn't." Elsewhere, we're told Peter brings a curse on himself. "I swear it wasn't me." You ever been motivated by fear? You ever let fear make decisions for you? It's also uncertainty. Peter has no idea what's going to happen. I wonder if someone has ever asked you a question, or you've ever been put on the spot in a way that you didn't expect, and you don't have time to think through all the consequences. So instead of integrity and honesty that comes out of your health, out of your mouth, it's like self-preservation and lie that comes out of your mouth. I think there's two kinds of people in the room, people who identify with that and people who are still lying to themselves. Like, that's just a human thing. In your pride, have you ever overestimated your ability to be strong? Pride. Peter thinks he's up to this. Peter's drawn the sword. He said, "Jesus, even if I have to die," Peter thinks he can do it. And his knees just buckled. When he got there, when it all happened, he intended to be a better man. And he just couldn't. He was just a failure. His knees just buckled. And I wonder if you've ever thought that you could be, and I'm not talking about strong in the Lord. That is available for you. I'm talking about in your own steam, you could just be a better person. You could just, it was all going to start right now. Like, you could do it. And in your self-righteousness, you just thought, "I can do it." And then you proved to yourself that you couldn't. I remember talking with somebody a few years ago who had cheated on his wife. And the overwhelming thing that I walked out of my office thinking is, first of all, I'm the youth pastor. Why is he telling me? But I remember over and over him saying, "This isn't who I am. I don't know how this happened." He did not know how he had failed. And part of me goes, "I know how you failed. You did this, 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 and this." Another part of me understands exactly. I have failed myself. I have failed God in ways that I said I thought I was a better person than this. I thought I could do it. Have you ever let yourself down? Have you ever promised God something and then proved yourself unable to fulfill that promise? You just stopped believing, you stopped trusting, you didn't have faith, life didn't make sense, you were scared, life happened, and you just weren't the person you thought you were. Peter had messed up. He was a fraud. Even after seeing Jesus post-resurrection, I think it's so compelling that Peter went back to fishing. He was training to be a rabbi, knew that God had big plans for him, but instead he was a fraud, he was a liar, he was just a fisherman the whole time. You know, I find Peter's story so compelling because, for a couple reasons, but one, in my experience, this is why people walk away from the church. I'm not talking about what keeps people who aren't believers out of the church. That might be a lot of things. That might be hypocrisy in the church or whatever we'd want to talk about. But as I've seen people I love leave the church, it usually starts with their own disappointment in their own actions. They messed up. Project some people at church are mad at me. Nobody at church is thinking much of me. But I've let God down. God wouldn't want me back. Have you been there? Most of the time I hear this passage taught, and it's something like, are you going to deny Jesus like Peter, or are you going to stand strong? I think the point of this passage is, haven't you denied Jesus? Have you neglected the poor? Then you've denied Jesus. Have you lied? Have you chosen material stuff over Christ? Have you neglected fellowship for your own purposes? I don't think this story encourages us. I don't think the primary thing to learn from Peter's story is that you need to be better than Peter. I think the primary thing to learn from Peter's story is that we're all in this together. And we desperately want to know, after I have failed, does God still love me? And you might be still religiously participating in church because it's what you've always done, but you might have an eating part of you in the inside this morning that just thinks, if everybody around here knew, if I was really honest, God wouldn't love me. I should just go back to fishing. This is not a story about how Peter's denial was all part of the plan either. You know, with Judas, you see Judas' story and we all go, well, yeah, but somebody had to betray him and Satan entered him and whatever. We don't have any of those clues with Peter. It just looks like Peter just did it. We don't see any like, wow, well, that led to... But we do have a story of Peter and Jesus, don't we? One page over in John 21, Jesus and Peter find themselves together after the resurrection, and Jesus calls Peter to him, replicating the miracle that Peter first learned of Jesus. And then in verse 15, they had finished breakfast, they had a meal together, and when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know I love you. Look, it's possible to love Jesus and fail. I say that again. It is possible to love Jesus. Do you think Peter didn't love Jesus? Was Peter lying when he said he loved Jesus? No, Peter just failed. Peter was a man and he messed up. You know that I love you, Lord, he said to him. Feed my lambs. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, tend my sheep. And he said to him a third time, much has been made of this, but three denials, three calls back. He said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? He made the parallel. Do you love me? And he said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. See, I don't think Peter's story is just about how we cannot fail like Peter. I think Peter's story is the story of how the victory of the cross is so all-consuming, that the grace of God is so abundant that it extends even to the one who denied Jesus. It extends even to you. That the forgiveness of the cross is so universal that there is no sin that stands between you and God if you would just return. Have you failed? Have you let yourself down? Have you felt like you let God down? Then would you know how God feels about you right now? Can you picture? In fact, would you do that? Would you close your eyes? Ignatius said it's okay for us to use our imaginations in prayer. So here we go. Could you close your eyes? And could you picture yourself back fishing, whatever that looks like for you? Aware of your failure? Aware that even though you thought you could do it, you thought you were strong enough, in the end, you just failed. And could you picture Jesus? And could you picture him calling you? Do you love me? Would you answer him? Do you love Jesus? Would you know that he has purpose for you? That he has mission for you, and that above all, he has grace for you, forgiveness for you.